We'll start in chapter 8 this morning, and we'll start talking about the breaking of the seventh seal. And this actually goes all the way through chapter 11. We'll talk about what all this means and hopefully the significance of it. And again, we're teaching the class from the standpoint that this is dealing with that this was written early and it was meant to tell the people of the church about the destruction of Jerusalem that was coming up and the encouragement to overcome. So we'll get it started this morning. When the Lamb broke the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. Another angel came and stood at the altar, holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him, so that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire of the altar and threw it to the earth. And there followed peals of thunder and sounds and flashes of lightning and an earthquake. And the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound them. The first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. And a third of the earth was burnt up, and a third of the trees were burnt up, and all the green grass was burned up. The second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the creatures which were in the sea and life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. The third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. And it fell on the third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. The name of the star is called Wormwood, and a third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. The fourth angel sounded, and the third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were struck, so that a third of them would be darkened, and the day would not shine for a third of it, and the night in the same way. Then I looked and I heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth because of the remaining blast of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." When the seventh seal is broken, he mentions here there's silence in heaven for about a half an hour. And the idea again, this final blow that's getting ready to come on Jerusalem. Turn to Habakkuk chapter 2. Again, this idea of silence before the throne. Someone read chapter 2, verse 20 of Habakkuk.
But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him.
Think of this is kind of the culmination of the Old Testament right here. And we've talked about this some. But the idea of everything up to Christ and the prophecies concerning all this. Look, turn to Matthew chapter 24 again, please, as we think about this. I'm going to read verse 21. It says, "For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will." And part of that, we've talked about part of this tribulation through the first six seals, and then we're going to see the culmination of it here. But also look at verses 29 through 31. And this is where I think we're getting ready to get to as we talk about this seventh seal. "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky in power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels and a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other." Now, again, as we talked before, this I don't think that this is talking about the end of time. This is talking about the end of that particular, what's the best way to say it, dispensation in the Old Testament. Because if you look in chapter or in verse 34, he says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." So it can't be the end judgment, because all these things took place during that generation. Okay? And that's what we're talking about here with Revelation. So again, this idea of the Son of Man coming back, it's the idea of the Son of Man giving out judgment on those who require to be judged at this time. So this is what I think we're getting ready to get into. So another angel came and stood at the altar holding a golden censer. Before that, they talked about the seven trumpets, and the idea of a trumpet is a wake-up call, a call to arms, those type of things. But here we talk about the angel holding a golden censer with incense. And go back to Revelation 6. Someone read verses 9 through 11, please, of chapter 6.
When he had opened his fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God, for the testimony which they held. They cried with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" White robes were given unto every one of them. It was said unto them that they should rest for a little season, until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled.
Okay. So here we're talking again about another angel came in verse 3 of chapter 8. Another angel came and stood at the altar holding a golden censer, and much incense was given him so that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar, which is before the throne. So we see here that the saints in chapter 6 were crying for judgment and avenging of their blood. And here we're getting ready to see those prayers answered. Think again that when we talk about the Old Testament was kind of a shadow, that the temple worship in the Old Testament was kind of a copy of the pattern that was already established in heaven. And so this idea of the altar, let's go back to Exodus chapter 30 as we think about this. Read verses 1 through 10. "Moreover, you shall make an altar as a place for burning incense. You shall make it of acacia wood. Its length shall be a cubit, and its width a cubit, and it shall be square, and its height shall be two cubits, its form shall be one piece with it. You shall overlay it with pure gold, its top and its sides all around, and its horns. You shall make a gold molding all around for it. You shall make two gold rings for it under its molding. You shall make them on the two side walls, on the opposite walls, and they shall be holders for poles with which to carry it. You shall make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. You shall put this altar in front of the veil that is near the Ark of the Testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is over the Ark of the Testimony, where I will meet with you. Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it. He shall burn it every morning when he trims the lamps. When Aaron trims the lamps at twilight, he shall burn incense. There shall be perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations. You shall not offer any strange incense on this altar, or burnt offering or meal offering, and shall not pour out a drink offering on it. Aaron shall make atonement on its horns once a year. He shall make atonement on it with the blood of the sin offering of atonement once a year throughout your generations. It is most holy to the Lord." Again, this idea of this altar that is in the presence of God, again, it's kind of what we see in the old temple is a copy of that. And again, the incense that's mentioned here, again, the prayers of his people. And you see that when he takes the fire from the altar and throws it to the earth here. Again, we remember what was told to us about Nadab and Abihu using strange fire. He used the fire from the altar the way it was supposed to be done. Again, so it's this idea of purity before God, and the fact that God does hear His saints, and God is going to those who persecute the church. We tend to think that people would get away with this thing, with this on this earth. And we see all these terrible things that have happened throughout history to Christians. That some of them have been killed, some of them have been made spectacles of, all those types of things. And it looks like people get away with it. That is just not the case. It's like any other sin. It's even worse, but it's like any other sin that there is no getting away with anything. In other words, I mean, anytime there's sin, no matter what it is, there has to be a payment for that. And it's either Jesus pays that price for us, or we pay the price for our own sins. And in this case, there's a payment that is due for what's been done. Think about one of the things that Jesus told them. He said that, you know, Jerusalem is going to be held responsible for every saint from the Old Testament, from Abel all the way down to Zechariah. They're going to be held responsible for the blood of all those people. When they killed the Christ, when they persecuted the church afterwards, and killed, we know of Stephen, we know of others that were killed during that time. They're going to be held responsible for every bit of blood from Abel on down to them. And the payments due. We start thinking about how awesome or how awful it is to fall into the hands of a righteous God when we're at fault. And I think that's one of the reasons why there was silence for half an hour in heaven when this seal was broke. Because it's getting ready to happen. And like he said, nothing before ever matched this, nothing afterwards will ever match what happened. So, Hebrews chapter 9, as we think about this altar again, Hebrews chapter 9, verses 3-4. Behind the second veil there was a tabernacle, which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna, and Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. And above it were cherubim and glory overshadowing the mercy seat, but of these things we cannot speak in detail. And he talks about, basically, this has all been replaced by Christ at this point. And now we're seeing what it looks like in heaven, that the saints, that God actually does hear the prayers of the saints, and the retribution is going to be made. So, when he throws the angels takes the censer and fills it with fire of the altar and threw it to the earth, and there were followed by peals of thunder and sounds and flashes of lightning and an earthquake. And the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. So the time's come. Let's look at what the first sound, the first trumpet sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. if you look in, turn, someone turn to Ezekiel chapter 13 verses and read verses 11 through 16, please. Yes, sir.
Saying to them with drug and untempered water, you shall fall. There shall be an overflowing shower, and ye of the great hailstones shall fall, and stormy wind shall rend it. Lo, when the wall is fallen, shall it not be said to you, words of doubting, wherewith you have been daubed, or wherewith you have daubed it. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, I will even rend him with stormy wind and my fury. There shall be an overflowing shower, my anger, great hailstones, and my fury to consume it. So will I break down the wall that you have done, and temper mortar, and break it down.
So
bring it down to the ground, that the foundation thereof shall be discovered. It shall fall, and you shall consume in the midst thereof, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Thus will I accomplish my wrath upon the wall, and upon them that have dug it, with the untempered mortar. And will say unto you, the wall is no more, neither they that daubed it. To wit, the prophets of Israel, which prophesied concerning Jerusalem, and which see visions of peace for her, there is no peace, saith the Lord God.
The point that I wanted us to get from this, is that in the Old Testament, the idea of hailstones are symbolized implements of war. God is going to bring the hailstones down and bring a city down, basically, is what he's talking about there. And one of the interesting things is I was looking at what Josephus had to say, because when the war starts, Rome attacks the region of Galilee first. And that's where they started the war at. And Josephus was the general of the Israeli army that was charged with protecting Galilee. So his group is the first group that sees action when Rome comes in to fight them. Okay? And what Josephus records is that the Roman army came in and used engines for throwing arrows, darts, and stones. In other words, these hailstones that we're talking about, which symbolize implements of war, he said that that these things were set on fire and thrown in. And these stones apparently weigh between 70 and 75 pounds. So they had the catapult type thing of throwing these stones into the area. And he said that Galilee was overfilled with fire and blood, is how he described it. And it's very similar to what is described right here in verse 7. The first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood. And they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. One of the things about that happened in Galilee was pretty quickly conquered. And Galilee basically was thought to constitute approximately a third of Israel. A third of the earth was burned up. So I mean, so there's a lot of things there that if we look at what Josephus had to say, and I know that it's not inspired writing, but he was an eyewitness of what happened in Galilee. And it does match up in a lot of ways to what we're reading here. As far as, I think that there's, in other words, I think there's evidence that he's talking about Rome coming in on Jerusalem right here is the point that I want to make. And I know that there's people, and there's probably, you could probably come up with some proof text or things that you hang your hat on if you said, well, I think that it's not Jerusalem, it's Rome, that type of thing. Maybe so. But the overarching point is this, is that God's kingdom overcomes. Keep that in mind, but it is really interesting how this matches up with a lot of what Josephus had to say. So I think you'll see it, kind of find it interesting here. But so Galilee was destroyed. He was taken captive at the time. And literally, in his writings, there was not anybody left to even take a message to the rest of their countrymen that they were destroyed. I mean, very few people survived it. Some were taken into captivity, but most of them were killed. And so, I mean, the Romans butchered them. We get to the second trumpet. The second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the creatures which were in the sea had life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. One of the interesting things is that right after Galilee was destroyed, people that were maybe just outside of that region decided they were going to go to Joppa and get on the boats. And so we're going to take this fight to the ocean. And so, of course, the emperor or the general of the Roman army, Vespasian, followed them into Joppa. And basically, many of them were destroyed as well. Let's look at a couple of things. When we talk about the great mountain burning with fire that was thrown into the sea, again, mountains oftentimes symbolize world powers in the Old Testament. Isaiah chapter 2. Verses 2 through 4. Here he's talking about the mountain of the Lord. Now it will come about in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations shall stream into it. So in other words, the mountain of the house of the Lord, his church, his kingdom. And so we talk about something like a great mountain burning with fire thrown into the sea. Again, it's the idea of a kingdom fall, being destroyed. But one of the ways that Josephus, he mentions this as well. Joppa was destroyed, and the Jews were determined to take the fight to the sea. And where they put in at, apparently the coast is extremely hazardous, rocky, and apparently they got out on the sea, and what he mentions was, at least in this particular battle, and apparently there were battles on the Sea of Galilee and the Mediterranean. Joppa would have been the Mediterranean. So what he says happened was, he said they got out to sea, there was a terrible storm, caused a lot of shipwreck and that type of thing. Many of them drowned in the water, and he said the water was red with blood. But also he mentions that there were some that tried to swim to shore, and the army was waiting on them when they got there and killed them when they got there. So there was no escape for any of them, and they lost most of their ships and all that during this as well. So Galilee's destroyed. Much of their navy's destroyed then after that, and we read all this. In other words, there's nowhere for anybody to run to. They're under the judgment of God. Verse 10. The third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and fell on the third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. The name of the star is called Wormwood, and a third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. One of the gentlemen that I read that I've gotten a lot of information from, as he talks about this idea of the great star falling from heaven. And again, stars a lot of times signify dignitaries. Look at Isaiah chapter 14. Twelve through 15. Here he's talking about, I think, part of some of the Babylonians here. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth. You have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. And I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch. Clothed with the slain, you are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. There is no power that's so great that God can't overthrow. And we saw that. We see that in the great kingdoms. I mean, the Babylonians, the Medes, and the Persians themselves, the Greeks, and then finally the Romans. Anybody that sets himself up against God is going to be destroyed. And here he's talking about a third angel sent, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. One of the arguments that I saw that was made was this coincides with potentially, and I say this because we there's no way we can know for sure. But Josephus was a great general of the Israelis. Of course, he's destroyed. His army is destroyed. And one of the things that's mentioned in his writings that's interesting, when he was defeated, the people thought he was dead initially. And there was basically national mourning because one of their great generals was gone who was helping to defend the homeland, basically, is how they looked at it. But then they eventually find out that he wasn't killed. And not only that, he is basically somebody who is being treated different from the other Jews by the Romans. In other words, he was given quarter, and if anything, he was an advisor and an advisor to the general for Rome now. So they looked at him, a traitor, that type of thing, a coward is what was said about him. And if you think about that, the idea that it made them more bitter, and he mentions this idea of bitter waters, it made them more bitter and want revenge. Because think about this. Probably a large number of their countrymen had been destroyed, killed. And he's been given quarter. So how would that make you feel? If you have family that's in the military, and their leader, not only is he not killed with them, but now he's helping the other side. What does it make you want to do? Makes you want to get them. And so they were bitter in that way, and they wanted to fight the Romans even more. So in other words, they didn't repent of anything of the problems that they had against God and against Rome. So that made them all the more determined, even in the light of pretty long odds against them being able to overcome Rome. I mean, they had to know. Okay, he's went through Galilee in a month, and this is where we're going to be at now. And so there was never any time where they were trying to be reconciled to Rome. They wanted to fight Rome to the death. But all this stuff that I've said about Josephus, I guess probably an attempt on my part to try to explain what these things mean. And I just want to make sure that we say this at the end of all this is that I don't know that we can say this with any, certainly not 100% certainty. it matches, much of what's said here matches what was said in Josephus, and you can make the case for it, and that's what I'm doing. But Josephus is not inspired. There may be other explanations to explain some of these symbols that we're seeing that I just don't know. And so, again, what I want us to make sure that we understand as we go through this, keep in mind the big picture of the major theme, which is God's kingdom is invincible, and those who are in His kingdom, those who remain faithful and overcome the world through Him, are victorious. Whether we're talking about Jerusalem right here, or whether we're talking about Rome or any other empire that might be brought up as a potential argument. But so keep that in mind. I think that there's a lot of evidence for the early day, and I think there's a lot of evidence for this talking about Jerusalem here. But obviously, I don't want you to think that I'm telling you that that's 100% solid in that way. So. Any comments or questions or anything? Okay. We'll pick up there next time. We'll pick up at the verse 12 on the fourth trumpet.